Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, why whales have menopause. Giant grandmas provide for the pod.
What we think is the role of these older females is to be repositories of ecological knowledge. You know, they go, oh, I remember 40 years ago when it was this kind of year and the wind was in the east. This is where the fish is.
And preparing to investigate the first space murder. A forensic scientist looks into blood splatters in zero G.
What's interesting is when you remove gravity, surface tension becomes the predominant force. And I'm looking at the angle at which blood drops strikes a target surface.
Plus, lifting the fog on the early universe, bees show just how much they can learn, and how the world is shaped by eating, pooping, and dying. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. So in my spare time, I try my hand at a bit of screenwriting, and I'm glad I have you here right now because I have a pitch for you. It's a detective series. Every episode, a body is discovered, brutally murdered. And here's the good part. We bring in a team of expert forensic scientists to study the scene and solve the crime. Now, I know what you're going to say. It's been done many times. But here's the difference. We do it in space, on the International Space Station. And we call it CSI ISS. Well, the best part is that we can base this on real science. The science that's being done by forensic detective Zach Kowalski, an expert on blood splatters. He's actually been thinking, what if there was a suspicious death in space? How would he analyze the crime scene? This led to a fascinating study involving some fake blood taking a ride on a microgravity parabolic flight. Mr. Kowalski is with the Roswell Police Department in Roswell, Georgia, and a PhD researcher with Staffordshire University. Hello, and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thanks for having me on.
What made you want to look at blood splatter in space?
My PhD research is within blood sample analysis, looking at how the environment and certain environmental variables affect and influence the accuracy of the measurements and interpretations that we make on, you know, any type of scene that has bloodshed. I'm also a huge space nerd. So I initially had just kind of proposed the concept to my advisor as a thought experiment. But one thing led to another, and we were actually able to do some hard data collection.
Well, before we get to the space environment, how important are blood stain analysis down here on Earth?
They can be incredibly important. If it is a scene, a criminal investigation where blood has been shed, the unique properties, the fluid dynamic properties and different types of behavior that blood can deposit on surfaces can help us understand what happened at the scene.
So how then did you study blood stain patterns in microgravity?
So, you know, like I had said, it started off initially as a thought experiment, and I had a friend who had retired out of California in the bloodstain community who knew somebody over at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And so I was put in touch with them. That set off a series of emails, basically, of putting me in touch through 6 degrees of separation with a researcher named Dr. George Panos out of the University of Louisville. And George is a space medicine, space surgery researcher who's well published on hemorrhage control. And we ended up connecting, and he was already conducting some research for hemorrhage control on parabolic flights. And, you know, he offered his time if he had any extra left over.
So what was it that you wanted to do on the microgravity flight?
When the airplane is going up and down on these parabolic arcs, it is causing about 15 to 20 seconds of a microgravity environment, right? And so that really forces you to boil down your research to the bare bones. What is that very specific question that you're looking to answer? And so for me, it was, I'm looking at the angle, understanding the angle at which a blood drop strikes its target surface and the accuracy of that angle. So the way that we calculate that angle is we measure the blood stain. We take the width of it, we take the length of it, we do some division, we apply the inverse sine, and we use trigonometric function to calculate the angle between that target surface and that blood droplet. That allows us to backtrack all these stains and start understanding where in three-dimensional space the blood originated from. So if you have to boil that down to the absolute bare minimum, I want to look at simple single drops interacting with a target surface. And so what we did was we took a syringe. We used a blood substitute because you can't really, there are biohazard concerns when you're in an enclosed environment like an airplane cabin. So you take that blood substitute in a syringe and you project it onto your target surface. And then we analyze and examine those stains that is created and measure and kind of do what we would do here terrestrially.
Oh, I see. So you were using a syringe like a squirt gun to squirt blood at a target. What was your target?
Target was a 6-inch by 6-inch cardstock of 50-pound butcher paper. It's a pound of butcher paper that we use here on Earth commonly within blood stain pattern analysis, education, and research.
Oh. Now, did you get to go on this zero-G flight and try the experiment yourself?
Nope, that was all George. I did all of the research analysis back here on Earth.
Well, that's too bad. I've been on one of those flights, and they're a lot of fun. So what were the results? What did you see?
So what's interesting is when you remove gravity, surface tension becomes the predominant force. And so what ends up happening is that surface tension inhibits that spread of the stain as it's interacting with the target surface. So as opposed to getting what you might commonly see as a 5-millimeter width, because surface tension is basically holding back that spread, you get like a 3.5-millimeter width.
So, yeah, surface tension, that's what causes liquids to form into balls. Like
yes.
We see astronauts playing with water on the space station and forms a sphere. So that's what you're saying happens to the blood.
Absolutely.
And that gives you a smaller spot on the wall when it hits the wall?
Yes, so it's preventing the stain from fully spreading like it would here on Earth.
So does that mean then, if you get a different result in microgravity, that it's going to be more difficult to solve crimes in space?
It just means that your area of origin where you're interpreting that stain as originating from would be different. It wouldn't be accurate. We even see it here on Earth. You know, different target surfaces cause blood to react differently, right? So if you take into account a blood stain falling on glass versus a blood stain falling on concrete, that concrete's really rough. It's going to cause the blood droplet to break different ways, and it's going to cause inaccuracy as opposed to something that's super flat and hard like glass. Mm. So we see it here on Earth, too. So I don't know that it would really inhibit our ability to investigate crimes. It's just another factor that we would have to take into account.
Well, how can the results that you saw in the microgravity help you understand more about bloodstains here on Earth?
It really drives home the fact that we are looking at surface tension being a major force in that bloodstain formation, right? So we're validating that concept because right now gravity is a big part of it. So it helps kind of drive point the home of understanding surface tension as it relates to the environment that it's in.
So just one last thing. Who do you think might kill whom in space in the future?
Oh, that's a great question, right? So I hope that it's not anything anytime soon within in my lifetime, right? Unfortunately, and I'm not trying not to be a pessimist, but where humanity goes, so too does our behavior. And we are inherently a bit of a violent species. So I hope that it's for several centuries, but I don't know. That's a bet I'm not willing to make.
Well, so far, space has been a very unifying environment. Let's hope it stays that way.
I completely agreed.
Mr. Kowalski, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely, Bob. Thank you for having me.
Zach Kowalski is a forensic detective in the Atlanta area and a PhD researcher with Staffordshire University. $13.8 billion ago, our universe exploded into existence, expanding from an infinitely hot and dense point. The first picture we have of the universe, the cosmic microwave background, shows it as a nearly uniform soup of hot matter, with the tiniest fluctuations in its nearly perfect plainness. Then, as that soup cools, the early universe goes dark for hundreds of millions of years. It's like there's a cosmic fog obscuring it. But at some point, something inside of the young universe breaks through the fog and clears it. So finally, the light of early stars can shine through. Well, now astronomers using the James Webb Space Telescope have shown us what cleared that fog. Dr. Hakim Atek from the Paris Institute of Astrophysics was part of the research team. Hello, Dr. Atek. Welcome to our program.
Hello. Thank you.
First of all, tell me about this mystery you were trying to solve from our early universe that we'd been unable to see.
Yes, so this is what we call a cosmic reionization. And as the introduction says, at some point in the universe, after the Big Bang, the universe was filled with this cosmic fog, which is neutral hydrogen. And we had theories for the sources that could have done the job. One of the theories is massive galaxies. And the other theory is supermassive black holes that could produce enough radiation to clear this fog. And another theory is small galaxies. And what we were able to show here is that small galaxies can actually produce enough radiation to clear this fog and transform the entire state of the universe.
Well, tell me about the fog and this reionization process that clears it.
So basically, neutral hydrogen is that you have a nucleus and an electron attached to it. And ionization is then when you have powerful radiation that can break the atom and the electron. So the universe becomes in ionized state, so the light can travel freely and the universe became transparent. And to do that, you need powerful sources of radiation that is able to break to take this electron off the hydrogen atom.
Okay, so it's literally like trying to clear the fog. You're changing it from one state to another, from the hydrogen to ionized hydrogen, then it becomes transparent. Is that the idea?
That's exactly the idea, yes.
How did you use the James Webb Space Telescope to figure out how this reionization process took place?
So we need to understand also that we have been trying to understand these sources of reionization for decades. And we have been trying with the most powerful telescope, which is this Hubble Space Telescope, until recently. And the main advantage of the James Webb Space Telescope is that it operates in the infrared, whereas the Hubble Space Telescope operates in the visible light. And when we look at distant galaxies, the light is shifted to the infrared because of the expansion of the universe. So James Webb brings these infrared capabilities, and also we are able to do spectroscopy, which means we can split the light of these distant galaxies in colors, just like a rainbow, which allows us to measure the physical properties of these galaxies and measure their ionizing power.
What did you aim the James Webb Space Telescope at to see these distant dwarf galaxies in this early process?
So we aimed the telescope at what we call the gravitational lens. So we need to understand also that these galaxies are so faint, so small, that even with the James Webb Space Telescope, we couldn't detect them. So we needed a little help from the universe itself using this gravitational lens. When you have a mass, it will distort space-time. When you have a lot of mass, like a cluster of galaxies, it will bend the light of distant background galaxies. Not only that, but it will also amplify the flux, the light of these background galaxies, distant galaxies. It's just like a magnifying lens in the universe. So thanks to that and the combination with the James Webb Space Telescope, we can see these very tiny distant galaxies.
Wow, so you use nature's magnifying glass. I'm thinking about what you see sometimes when you look through a big drop of water and everything gets magnified.
That's the same phenomenon. Yes, you can think also of the bottom of a wine glass. You can also amplify some sources of light behind it. So we really combined the JWST and another nature's telescope to see these small galaxies.
So how far back in time were you looking?
So we are talking about 500 million years to a billion years of the age of the universe. So more than 13 billion years ago.
Boy, what did you see?
So we see, surprisingly, that these tiny galaxies are prolific producers of ionizing radiation. They are so efficient at producing this ionizing energetic radiation that they are capable of a global transformation of this neutral gas in the universe. As a matter of fact, their production of ionizing radiation is four times higher than what we expected for normal galaxies, like massive galaxies as we know them. And the second important point is their number. So they are 100 times more numerous, more abundant than the massive galaxies. So their sheer number combined to their efficiency at producing this radiation, collectively they emit enough radiation to reionize the universe.
Now, when you say tiny galaxies, what do you mean?
To give you an idea, our galaxy, the Milky Way, is what we call a massive galaxy. So it has 100 billion of stars. So these tiny galaxies have only 1 million of stars. So it means that they are 100,000 times smaller than the Milky Way.
How long did this whole process take from the universe being enveloped in this dark fog to having that fog cleared so the light could spread throughout the whole universe?
So we think that it took about 500 million years, around that.
What's your next step?
The next step is now to go even farther, or even fainter, I would say, to detect maybe the first galaxies that form in the universe. So we hope to see, to witness the birth of the first stars and the first galaxies.
Wow. Dr. Atek, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Hakeem Atek is an astrophysicist at the Paris Institute of Astrophysics. Hot flashes, insomnia, mood swings, the ubiquitous signs of someone going through menopause. As common as these menopause symptoms can feel for humans, across the animal kingdom, we can only assume they're quite rare, mostly because not a lot of animals live beyond their reproductive years. It turns out that as an evolutionary adaptation, menopause is rare. Out of 5,000 species of mammals, only 6 are known to experience menopause. One of them is us. The other 5 are toothed whales, like belugas and killer whales. A new research study released this week explored why this is. Dr. Sam Ellis is a psychologist at the Center for Research in Animal Behavior at the University of Exeter in the UK. He led the study. Hello and welcome to our program.
Pleasure to be here.
Why is menopause strange in the animal kingdom?
We are so used to the idea of menopause, about this late life, post-reproductive period that women have in humans, that we don't really stop to think how actually unusual as an evolutionary strategy it is. You're trying to get as many offspring into the next generation as you can. The best way to do that is almost always going to be to reproduce for your whole life. And that's indeed what most mammals do. So this is a really unusual strategy. And I think we're just not used to thinking about this unusual strategy because we're so used to it.
Well, we know that the other animals that do have menopause are whales. They are notoriously challenging to study. So take me through, how did you study menopause in whales?
They are difficult to study. And so in lots of ways, they're a very hard group to try and ask this question in. But in other ways, we're actually very lucky, because in lots of whales, we know very little about them. But what we do know comes from these tragic mass mortality events. For example, these mass strandings you read about. And generations of scientists have gone to these mass mortality events and taken biological samples from the whales. So, and importantly, for the purpose of this research, They've collected the ages of whales who strand. With whales, you can find out their age by cutting open their teeth and counting their rings like a tree, and also looking at their ovaries to determine their reproductive status. So to do this research, I scoured the literature to try and build a database of these different data sets from all across the world for the last 40 or 50 years, trying to gather everything together in one place. And I actually found 250 data sets from 30 or so species of whale. And this is what we used to base the study on.
So which ones have menopause?
So the species with menopause are killer whales, false killer whales, short-finned pilot whales, and belugas and narwhals. And they represent four independent evolutions in those five species. So once in the branch leading to killer whales, false killer whales, and short-finned pilot whales, and then once in the branch leading to both narwhals and belugas.
So what kind of advantages does menopause give a species?
So what we try to do with the research is to try and ask this question. Why? Why does this unusual trait evolve? Mm-hmm. And what we found is that this extension of lifespan allows the older females to spend much longer alive at the same time as their grand offspring. What this means is that in species with menopause, females can expect to live long enough to see one of their grandchildren reach maturity. Whereas in species without menopause, on average, females only live long enough to see one of their grand offspring reach a third of the age of maturity. So in humans, that would be reaching the age of 5 or 6. And this is a really big difference. And this feeds into things that are sometimes called the grandmother effect. And what this is, the idea is that this lifespan is extended to allow older females to help their offspring and grand offspring and help keep them alive.
Well, we've talked about the grandmother hypothesis on our show before, mm-hmm. This idea that humans evolved menopause so they could take care of their grandchildren. So are you seeing a similar thing in whales?
So this, yeah, exactly feeding into this. So in this study, we sort of took this comparative approach and found that there's really big opportunities in all the species with menopause for this intergenerational help effect. So it seems like a really important part of the story. In some previous research studying killer whales, we've tried to really nail down into this effect in the killer whales. And we found very similar patterns to you found in humans, that the presence of a post-reproductive grandmother increases the survival chances of their offspring and grand offspring. And the way they do this is by, when food is scarce, they lead their group, and they also share their food with their group. They provide help to their relatives. And this is exactly the grandmother effect that we'd find in humans.
Ah, I wonder if there's also sort of a knowledge transfer where the grandmother would say, well, I know where the good food sources are.
Exactly. So these killer whales that we study live off the west coast of the US and Canada, right on the border. And they feed on salmon. So they're called the resident killer whales, and they feed exclusively on salmon. And the salmon go through these big cycles based on the El Nino and La Nina effects. And what we think is the role of these older females is to be repositories of ecological knowledge. You know, they go, oh, I remember 40 years ago when it was this kind of year and the wind was in the east, this is where the fish is. We think this is one of the really big benefits, that these older females acting as repositories of knowledge.
So why then would whales and humans have menopause but no other species on the planet?
It's a really good question. And I think it really comes down to this social structure idea. What was really striking in the research that we've done is that the pathway by which menopause evolves is both the same in all of the whales that have menopause, but also very similar to what we think happened in humans. And really, those ideas I was talking about with grandmother effects really come down to social effects. And so you need the right kind of social system and the right kind of ecological pressures to make this really pay off. For a start, you need to be living with your grand offspring. In lots of mammals, individuals disperse when they reach maturity and they never see their family again. So that means that you can't get any of these benefits, so you may as well carry on reproducing.
Well, what you found in whales tell us about how humans evolved menopause?
What's really striking about this research is that the pathway by which menopause evolved in whales multiple times is the same as the pathway we think happened in humans. Humans are quite difficult to study in a comparative context just because we have such a different lifestyle to our closest relatives. But whereas the whales, we've got this repeated evolution that allows us to really dig into this, which really allows us to show that it seems like there's just one pathway to reach menopause. Again, highlighting what an unusual strategy this is. And there's only one way to get there. The only way to get there is to extend your lifespan and use that to help your relatives, but also to stop reproducing, to avoid competing with your relatives. It's this split strategy seems to be the only way to reach this unusual strategy.
Just one last thing. Do you know if whales get menopause symptoms like humans do, you know, hot flashes and such?
That's a really interesting question. And the short answer is we don't. So we know from some work in the killer whales that by collecting the poop, some researchers have been able to look at hormone changes, and the hormone changes happening in whales seem very similar to the hormone changes that happen in humans. But beyond that, we don't know about any behavioral effects.
Dr. Ellis, thank you so much for your time.
Really great to speak to you.
Dr. Sam Ellis is a psychologist at the Center for Research in Animal Behavior at the University of Exeter in the...
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
UK. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the program, a scientist explores the Earth's circulatory system from an unusual perspective.
We haven't really thought about the role of feces in lots of ecosystems, because very few of us have probably ever seen a whale poop. I have, and it's beautiful.
Bees are amazing creatures. Many species live in complex societies with advanced methods of communication. It's from bees that we get the concept of the hive mind. But bees don't necessarily need a hive to be smart. A new study has shown that even as individuals, they have remarkable learning abilities that allow them to learn complex, multi-step processes. But beyond that, their sociality allows them to magnify the impact of that learning by teaching other bees, which might go a long way to explaining the power of the hive mind. Dr. Alice Bridges, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Sheffield, was part of the team. Hello and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Just what kind of bee learning were you investigating in your work?
Basically, we already know that bees are really good at learning things from each other and themselves that can be really unusual. Things like pulling on strings to get inaccessible rewards, or rolling little balls to a particular location to get a reward in exchange for that. But this time we wanted to test something even more complex, basically see how far we can push it. All of these behaviors that we've sort of played around teaching the bees so far have been kind of one single step. So what we wanted to look at this time is, can they learn a behavior that has multiple components that they have to perform in turn before they can get the reward at the end?
So you're teaching them things that they couldn't invent themselves, behaviors that they wouldn't come up with on their own.
Yeah. I guess the importance of this would be, so far up until this paper was published, and there was a similar one with similar results published the same week in chimpanzees, we'd never actually shown that any animal other than humans could learn something that was so complicated that while they could learn the complete form of the behavior socially from another individual, that they couldn't have come up with that during sort of individual trial and error learning where they didn't have any social input.
Well, take me through your experiment. What was the task that you wanted the bees to do, and how did you train them to do it?
So we made this puzzle box. Basically, the principle is we make this box out of like a Petri dish lid. And it's got these little sort of foam doors on it that the bees can push against. And so they can rotate this lid. And what that does is it exposes this little colored target on which we've put some sugar water. But in this case, before they can do that, they have to move an obstacle out of the way of this door. So they have to push another door out of the path of the main door that they really want to be rotating to get their reward. They don't get a reward for the first step, removing the first door. They have to do both things before they can get it. So basically what happens is we start with the box fully open to train a bee, and then we give them boxes with increasingly difficult configurations, so rotating the lid further and further round. They wouldn't move the obstacle from in front of the door when we tried to move it. in the end, what we had to do was we had to put a temporary reward in exchange for them doing that until they could do both, and then take it away, which, again, they really, really hated that.
So this was very much something they would not normally do. They don't like to do it naturally.
No.
And but you managed to coax them. You trained them to do it, and they figured it out.
Yeah. We had to do all sorts. We had to bribe them by increasing the reward at the end massively. We had to very carefully take it away from only some of the boxes we gave them, and then more of the boxes over time. And often they would sort of throw a little tantrum and not want to take part anymore, and we'd have to sort of give them an open box to tempt them back to please try again. And finally they would accept that this was how it was going to be. They had to do both things.
But eventually they did learn that they could do this effectively and get their sugar reward, even though the first task did not give them a reward.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the first step. You train a bee to learn how to open this two-step puzzle box. Now, what about the next step when other bees were brought in?
Well, at this point, I was sort of thinking there's no way they're going to be able to learn this. But the really surprising thing was when we paired up our trained bees with bees that had never seen the puzzle box before, they were totally naive to it. They were actually able, some of them, to learn the complete behavior from observing the trained bee open the boxes, and they could follow them around on the surface of the box, and they could get in there when the trained bee had opened it and steal some of the reward.
Wow. So it was sort of like shadowing somebody on a job.
Yeah, definitely. They would actually, it was sort of quite striking how they would follow them. They'd often they'd be so close that the antennae would be touching the body of our trained bee. And wherever that bee would walk on the surface of the box, the observer bee would follow.
And you were not involved in this process at all?
Well, aside from us letting the bees in together, but to actually see these tiny, tiny little creatures, brains a fraction of the size of ours, do something that until they'd done it, it was basically thought only humans were able to do. It was kind of staggering.
So is this something that you would consider to be cultural learning in the bees?
So this is interesting. So with animals, it's broadly accepted that you can define non-human culture as a behavior that's socially learned, and that is basically it's held within a group over a period of time. So members of this group will continue performing that behavior. And at first, people thought that only humans had culture, and it was sort of the explanation for our species' success. But then we found plenty of examples of animals having culture, and then things sort of shifted, and people thought it was, I guess, the nature of human culture, the fact that we could learn these behaviors that were so complicated that we couldn't have individually come up with them ourselves. This is what's allowed us to go to the moon. It's allowed us to split the atom. Now we've seen that bumblebees have at least the capacity to learn a behavior that is so complicated they couldn't innovate it themselves. And yes, it's not exactly splitting the atom, but the underlying principle is there, essentially. Basically, this finding that they are able to learn something so impressive, it definitely suggests that they have the capacity.
What was it like working with the bees?
It's really interesting. So for me, I actually became allergic during my PhD. So a lot of the time, yeah, I had to spend in a bee suit sort of watching students putting their hands in the boxes with the bees and kind of pointing. I had a lot of fun, especially when you're working with a particular bee over a long time. You can really sort of see the character of that individual. They get more used to you.
Dr. Bridges, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Alice Bridges is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Sheffield. She investigated bee learning at Queen Mary University of London for her PhD. Mm-hmm. You don't have to look very hard to see the effects of humans on the world around us. But take a second glance, and you can also see how other animals have shaped our environment as well. From the tiniest insects to the gigantic whales, animals have played an important role on our planet, moving nutrients around through the basic act of consuming, excreting, and ultimately dying. Through this, they sustain life as we know it. In a new book, conservation biologist Joe Roman details all the ways that animals make and remake our world and explores how protecting animals can help fix some of the damage that humans have done. Dr. Roman teaches at the University of Vermont, and his book is called Eat, Poop, Die: How Animals Make Our World. Hello, and welcome to our program.
Thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Now, in your book, you say that if forests are the lungs of the planet, then animals are its circulatory system. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think most of us are familiar with what trees and plants do, right? They absorb carbon dioxide and emit oxygen. But the one thing about trees and plants is they tend to stay in one place. Animals, on the other hand, can walk, swim, fly vast distances, sometimes thousands of kilometers. And when they do, they eat in certain places, and they poop in others, and they can even die in others. So the way this circulatory system works is, think of something like a seabird. Eats in the ocean, comes to an island or a beach in order to breed, and poops, right? One pasty poop at a time, they're releasing nutrients from the ocean onto land. And every animal does something like this, but some, like the largest on the planet, whales, for example, eat 2 or 3% of their body weight each day, and they also have to defecate that back out. And that impacts not only the plankton in the oceans, but the entire ocean ecosystem.
Now, you also say in your book that this is an overlooked process. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think for a couple of reasons. One, I study the oceans, and often the focus has been on bacteria and on microbial processes, and they're really important in the ocean. That is, they're at the base of the food web. Think of phytoplankton, which is microscopic. And for a long time, we really thought that animals were kind of like passengers, right? They would feed on it, but they didn't really have much of an impact. And I think one of the reasons for that bias is we live in a world that's really bereft of wild animals. I was shocked to find when I was working on the book that right now, 96% of the biomass of all mammals on the planet is either humans or domestic animals like cows and sheep. Only 4% of all mammals on the planet are wild. So it kind of makes sense that we don't think that's important, that they're that important, because we've taken them out of the systems, not only where we live, but also out of the oceans. Mm-hmm. So one of my colleagues, Chris Dowdy, came up with this idea of the circulatory system, and he was looking at Pleistocene animals. We think right now on land as bison, the American buffalo, as being relatively large. They were diminutive. They were little compared to the mastodons, mammoths, giant sloths that were roaming across the Americas. So my dream is to start thinking about what it would be like if these wild animals started to come back and how that would change the ecosystems where we live.
Well, do you think part of the issue of dealing with this nutrient conveyor belt, as you call it, is because we don't really like talking about poop? We don't like coming across it in the forest. We sort of want it to be out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, there's probably some of that too, unless, of course, you have a five-year-old, then the talk of poop is probably pretty common. Or if you have a dog like I do, and I had to make sure I took her out and walked her before we had this conversation. But you're right, we haven't really thought about the role of feces in lots of ecosystems, because very few of us have probably ever seen a whale poop. I have, and it's beautiful.
What drew you to studying that?
Amazingly, my first day as a researcher, I was on the Bay of Fundy off the coast of Nova Scotia, and we were studying a critically endangered species, the North Atlantic right whale. And this was in the late 1990s, and the first whale I saw came up to the surface. It had some mud on its bonnet or its head because it was diving deep to feed on copepods, came up to breathe, rest for a moment, and then just before it fluked or dove, it released this enormous fecal plume. It stank. It was a terrible smell. It was large, but we went right in the middle of it and collected some. At that point, we were looking at the researchers were looking at what they ate and maybe their reproductive status through the hormones. But it started, sort of the wheels started turning for me, like, wow, you know, what could be the impact of this feces, especially when whales were really abundant? Now there are only about 350 right whales on the planet, sadly. At some point, there were 10,000. How might those whales have influenced the ocean ecosystems, and how do they do it now?
Now, you referred to whale poop as beautiful. Mm-hmm. What's it actually like?
Yeah. It varies as much as I like to, since I'm here in Vermont, it reminds me of something that Snowflake Bentley said, that every snow crystal is unique and a miracle in its design. And I think that every whale poop is unique too. It can be as big as our research boat with and quite strong smelling. I can think of humpback whales. It can be very thin. It looks and light green, looks kind of like oversteeped green tea. For blue whales that are feeding on krill, it can float at the surface in these beautiful bright pink lumps. And that's just three species. The variety is enormous. So if you're ever lucky enough to be on a whale watch boat and you see a whale poop, check it out.
Okay, they don't usually advertise that, but let's look at just the whales then. Mm-hmm. What's our understanding of how they contribute to this so-called conveyor belt and how it's been changing in recent years?
There's two ways that whales can influence ocean ecosystems. One is what we call a whale pump, and that's by diving, feeding, and taking the nutrients from deep beneath the ocean surface, coming to the surface and releasing these fecal plumes. So it's moving vertically, this whale pump. But what whales do also is most whales migrate thousands of kilometers every year. They feed off the coast of, say, Alaska or off the coast of Nova Scotia, and then they breed in places like the Caribbean or Hawaii. If you've ever been to a tropical beach, you know the waters are often blue and clear, and that's in part because they have very low nutrients. What the whales are doing is feeding in high nutrient areas, migrating down to these tropical islands and releasing all these nutrients, not in the poop because they're not feeding, but in their pee. So it's not just poop, it's also pee. And in some places, like off the coast of Hawaii, humpback whales release as much nitrogen into that system as all of the natural processes there. So they can double the productivity in those areas. Nitrogen is the limiting factor here. So this great whale conveyor belt also plays an important role of connecting high latitude to low latitude systems, and probably in the past was enormously important.
Now, whales were hunted, you know, almost to extinction in some cases. So what effect has the reduction in their populations had on the ocean conveyor belt?
Yeah, an enormous one. So that this conveyor belt would have been probably, you know, maybe 10% or 20% of what it was historically. The good news is some species like humpbacks have come back. Others like the North Atlantic right whale haven't. So the nutrients that used to go to these coral reef systems no longer get there. It probably had an impact on the productivity in those areas. And, you know, when we've been in the water, you can see fish feeding on the skin of these whales, and also fish are feeding on the leaked milk from the mom. So you'll see a calf feeding on its mom, and then you'll see it surrounded by small fish feeding on the milk in that area.
So what's being done to understand the role of whales even further?
Animals also die. And when a whale dies, that carcass is enormous, of course. We don't have trees, large trees in the ocean, but we do have large animals. So when the whale dies, hundreds of species can either feed on that, whether it's sharks or crabs, but also there are some, like worms that don't have mouths or guts or anuses, that just live on the bones of whales. So not only is it this movement of nutrients, but it's also dead whales form these unique habitats throughout the world. And when you asked about what happened as a result of commercial whaling, we did a model and think it's possible that the first extinctions in the ocean were these deep sea organisms reliant on dead whales, because we took all the habitat out.
Now, you mentioned earlier about seabirds, and you have a wonderful chapter in the book where you talk about your adventure to the island of Surtsey off Iceland, which is a brand new island, a volcano that emerged out of the depths, and how life began there in this sterile land, starting with seabirds. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's a great story. And Iceland really did well. So it erupted in 1963. It just had its 60th birthday last year. And a couple of fishermen were out on the water and they noticed the smell of sulfur and they looked, checked their engine, and there was nothing wrong with the engine. And then they were caught in this whirlpool. And within a few moments, there was an enormous eruption column. The island formed over the following years. Initially, some biologists and volcanologists landed on the island, but it was still too active for people to stay. So they would come on and then they would rush off. But after a couple of years, you know, there's very little life. A few seeds were landing there, but only the maritime seeds that brought their own nutrients could survive on the coastline. But then everything started to change about 5 years after the eruption, with the arrival of herring gulls, blackback gulls, fulmars, and other bird species. They, of course, got their food in the ocean, but they nested on land. When they got to the land, they would spread their feces at about 3 ounces per day, each bird. And if you look up Surtsey now, you can see a bright green meadow in the middle of black lava, and that's where the breeding birds were found. Ecology is often hard to study, studying whales and other species, but here's a system where they were looking at it from the very first day. So they've been recording every bird, pretty much every plant, and those changes over time, and almost all of it comes down to the feces of the seabirds.
Well, take me through that sequence. How did life get established from the seabird feces up to a meadow?
Right. Sure. What the seabirds are doing, of course, they're feeding on fish or sometimes even on land. I saw a seabird feeding on pizza in Reykjavik one day. So they're feeding all around. They land in this area and they are, not only are they defecating, but they're also releasing seeds. Seeds might get caught in their feathers. So the estimate is about 2/3 of all the plants on the island, there are about 80 of them on the island right now, arrived on the feathers and wings and legs of seabirds. So not only are they the transport, but they're also the fertilizers. And this benefits the birds as well, because now they have more places to nest, right? So you can see this ripple effect with the larger birds often nesting in the center, the smaller birds being pushed out. But that increases this meadow. And as one of the biologists there quipped, you know, it's so deep and so thick, we could have cows out there and fresh milk every day. The good news is Surtsey was protected in the 1970s, and it's now a World Heritage Site. There are plenty of rocks in the ocean. You know, it's not the only volcanic island there. But what the Icelanders did is they restricted access. I was one of only 12 people that got to go on the island in 2021. So wow. They are very strict about people and whether they can access this. And I'll tell you, one funny thing is they once found a plant that they couldn't identify out behind the research station. They brought it back to the botanist. And he's like, oh, yeah, I think this is a tomato plant. So it actually had probably gotten through the latrine instead of the bird itself. So they're careful to bury everything now, or to go actually onto the ocean, you know, right to the edge of the ocean.
Oh, so humans are also part of this conveyor belt.
We are. That's absolutely we are. That's right.
You've also talked in the book about how bird droppings or guano was actually mined in days gone by.
For sure. I mean, you know, one of the challenges with agriculture in the Americas as well as in Europe was that nitrogen and phosphorus was scarce, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries. And Alexander Humboldt was one of the first, the German scientist, to discover guano. And he brought it back and they found it had some of the highest levels of phosphorus and nitrogen of any product they had. And that started really what was a gold rush for the guano. By the way, the native Inca knew it all along. They had been using guano and Humboldt was a little bit skeptical. But the natives had been aware of just how valuable this seabird guano could be. And it One author suggests that it might be guano and not petroleum that really sparked the industrial age and the Anthropocene.
Okay, that's the large animals. Mm-hmm. What about the smaller creatures, even down to insects? How do they shape our planet by cycling nutrients around?
Sure. I mean, if we think about the circulatory metaphor, you know, we're talking about the arteries and the veins and these large pathways through the planet. I think of the insects sort of like the capillaries, right? They're moving nutrients too, but generally in shorter distances, and most often through their carcasses. When I was in Iceland, I was lucky enough to visit a lake called Mývatn, which means Midge Lake, and it gets that name because the midges are in a larval stage at the bottom of the lake, and every couple of years they emerge in the trillions. It looks like a fog up over the island when they emerge, and they breed away from the lake, and then when they die, they nutrient the grassland. They fertilize the grasslands. And, you know, the scientists were really excited when they started getting some numbers about this. So they went to the local farmers to tell them how important the midges were. And the farmers were like, oh, yeah, we have this term migras, which means midge grass, that is, you know, that marks every 3 or 4 years when the midges emerge, and that allows them to get through the winter. So, of course, the locals had been aware of this for a long time. But that's another example where animals can bring nutrients from one system to another, and without them, the ecosystem will change.
You also talk about cicadas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I was very lucky I was there for one of the 17-year emergences. I went down to Maryland also in 2021. And if you've ever been through a cicada emergence, the noise is amazing. You know, you can barely talk to the person next to you. I thought of the trees as singing trees. It was so loud. But they're so abundant that when they come up, the birds and the other predators, they'll start feeding on them, but they can't possibly feed on all of them. So there will be up to 3 inches or 4 inches of basically dead cicada carpet around the trees and a lot of the forest and even in some suburban areas. That, of course, also has nutrients. So they're bringing those. They spend 17 years beneath the surface of the soil. Then they spend only a couple of weeks above the surface. And then they die and they're bringing these nutrients back into the system in new areas.
So how have all of these processes changed in the past century because of human interference?
Oh, yes, sure, enormously. As I had said, one of the things is that we've eradicated so many wild mammals and taken out a lot of the wild birds, and even insect populations are declining. So this movement of nutrients that used to occur all around us, I think of it in some way, you can read about this when you read early explorers or people writing in the Americas a couple hundred years ago. Animals were like the weather. They called passenger pigeons. It was like a biological storm, correct? So in the past, I really do. I made up the term meteor zoology or zoometeorology as a way to describe what the world could be like and was when humans were just part of the ecosystem and wild animals were all around us. My dream is somehow to get back to that. You know, aspiration is at least for us to experience the everyday wonder of having wild animals around us, and then also to see the changes in the forests, in the grasses, in the oceans around us.
And do you think it really can be done, that we can restore this conveyor belt and keep these nutrients flowing around the planet through the animals?
I'm sure we can do this because I've seen the changes. I mean, really in 50 years, two examples, humpbacks off the coast of Australia are now back to the numbers they probably were before people arrived. They were down to 600. They're up at about 25,000. And similarly for sea lions, elephant seals in the North Pacific, they were once down to 25 individuals. They're now well over 100,000. So we can do it animal by animal, but it really takes an ecosystem.
Dr. Roman, thank you for the book and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Dr. Joe Roman is a conservation biologist from the University of Vermont. His new book is Eat, Poop, Die:
how animals make our world. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Rosie Fernandez, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebens. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.